Do you like it?
I do.
Or you don't. You don't like it at all. Usually you always tell me what you think.
What is this?
You're lying.
As I think you know, Alma, I prefer my asparagus with oil and salt. And knowing this, you've prepared the asparagus with butter. Now, I can imagine in certain circumstances being able to pretend that I like it made this way. Right now, I'm just admiring my own gallantry for eating it the way you've prepared it.
I don't know what I'm doing here.
You're listening to the Plain Label Podcast. Hello and welcome back to the Plain Label Podcast. I am your host, Eric Williams, and in this episode, we are with heavy hearts as we conclude our look at writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson with the 2017 film Phantom Thread. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest Mr. Ben Teed.
Hello, thanks for having me, Eric.
Absolutely. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that we are proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Just search Deliberate Noise in your podcast app for more great shows from the network. And we are also sponsored by Audible. For you, the listeners of Plain Label Podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to check them out. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/plainlabel. Again, that is audibletrial.com/plainlabel for your free audiobook. Mr. Teed, what are you drinking for me this evening?
I'm glad you asked, because tonight it's a cider.
Oh, of course it is. Yes.
But I have some left over from Halloween.
You are on brand. I love it.
I am. I'm on brand. I you probably will hear me say some of the same things in these past episodes as you will in this one. This is also from Blake's. You know, I love Blake's cider up in Michigan. And this is their Halloween cider. It's called Apple Lantern. Roasted pumpkin and molasses hard cider. It's 6.5, and it is, hand-picked apples balanced in the oven, roasted richest of pumpkin and molasses. It just tastes like fall. Like, me and my wife both just go, oh, man. You know, we got these in the summer when we went and visited.
Yeah.
And we saved them, and now that Halloween has passed us and all that, I'm just now drinking, like, you know, now that the season, you know, is kind of winding down or whatever.
Sure.
I'm trying to get through all my fall stuff.
You got to churn it out before you get all that Christmas, that candy cane flavor.
It's got to get inside me. Yes, exactly. So, and I thought, well, this is where I'm going to drink it all. So here we are.
I like it. I am also going with something in the fall variety. It is from Sam Adams. It is their Oktoberfest. And the reason I'm having this is because, and she's probably not going to be pleased when she gets home, is my wife, that was way too much like Borat than I anticipated. Because my wife loves herself some pumpkin everything. Like, she's one of those basic girls.
Mm-hmm.
And she likes her pumpkin stuff. And so she enjoys the fall / winter beers, and so she saw the Oktoberfest Sam Adams, and with it, you know, going out of season pretty soon, she decided to pick up a couple of six packs of that. And I will say that she needs to get home soon, because some of them will be gone.
She better hurry,
and I will end up being the villain of the night. So that's how that's gonna go. Mr. Teed, let's go ahead and kick off our discussion. The 2017 film, Phantom Thread.
You can sew almost anything into the canvas of a coat. When I was a boy, I started to hide things in the linings of the garments. Things that only I knew were there. secrets.
Good morning.
Will you have dinner with me?
Yes.
I feel as if I've been looking for you for a very long time. You look beautiful. Very beautiful. I have things I want to do. Things I simply cannot do without you.
Reynolds has made my dreams come true, and I have given him what he desires most in return. Every piece of me. Why are you not married?
Her arrival has cast a very long shadow.
She's barely looked at you this evening, has she?
May I warn you of something? My brother can feel cursed, that love is doomed for him.
I don't like the fabric.
Maybe one day you'll change your taste.
Maybe I like my own taste.
Just enough to get you into trouble.
Perhaps I'm looking for trouble.
Stop!
There is an air of quiet death in this house.
You're not cursed, you're loved by me. Stop playing this game.
What game? What precisely is the nature of my game?
All your rules and your clothes and all this money and everything is a game.
This was an ambush.
Stop.
Are you sent here to ruin my evening and possibly my entire life?
Stop it! Whatever you do, do it carefully.
And the IMDb plot synopsis of this one, Mr. T, goes like this. Set in the glamour of 1950s post-war London, renowned dressmaker Reynolds Woodcock and his sister Cyril are at the center of British fashion, dressing royalty, movie stars, heiresses, socialites, debutantes, and dames with a distinct style of the House of Woodcock. Women come and go through Woodcock's life, providing the confirmed bachelor with inspiration and companionship until he comes across a young, strong-willed woman, Alma, who soon becomes a fixture in his life as his muse and lover. Once controlled and planned, he finds his carefully tailored life disrupted by love. And that was written by Focus Features, and I cannot believe that last line.
So
carefully
they didn't watch the movie, huh?
Tailored life disrupted by love. Jesus Christ. People get paid to write that Ben Teed, and I cannot believe it.
That was weird. I mean, unless they have some sort of similar setup in their marriage. I mean, as you know, as a married man yourself, marriage is all about working together and having a system worked out.
Gotta have a system.
Someone has to be usually stepped on in some capacity, or taken advantage of.
There's always there's the reacher and then there's the settler, Mr. Teed.
Right. And at different points of your married life, the roles can switch.
That's right.
Depending on what the situation is, and to understand that, this was one that Samantha, my wife, and I both really responded very strongly to.
Okay, tell me about it.
Well, once we got through Inherent Vice.
Yes.
Or at least I did, because she didn't make it.
Yes.
If you'll remember.
If you recall.
She did definitely want to be a part of Phantom Thread. So one night we sat and watched it, and both came away very strongly. It was very quick. We were excited to see supposedly Daniel Day-Lewis's last performance. I'll believe it when I see it.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't see it, I guess. But he, once again, is perfectly cast. It's like this role was written for him. He's such a clean, thin, just perfectly, I don't know. He's just very proper guy. Throughout the whole thing, he just looks very well dressed. He's extremely, you know, this is also the first time I think we've seen a movie by Paul Thomas Anderson where it doesn't take place in California, right?
Mm.
I think that's right. Well, I don't know if you count Junoon from 2015. That takes place over in India, I believe.
I think this would be the only one.
I think this is the only one, because this definitely takes place in London, right?
Yeah.
The House of Woodcock. And, yeah, and there was just something about, once again, I think this is a this is more of a return to form, much in the way of Master or There Will Be Blood for me. I think that we've come to expect kind of a certain type of artistry, but in some ways this is also morphed as well. There's heavy influences of Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca in this film, which is why I also watched Rebecca recently to kind of understand the film. Are you familiar? Have seen Rebecca?
Yeah.
Okay, so Cyril, the character of Cyril, definitely relates to the woman in that film that is kind of obsessed with Rebecca, and how she kind of takes care of the house and is always trying to compare the lady that comes into the life, you know, in this case it's Alma, and how she'll never truly compare to the woman of Woodcock's dreams, which happens to be his mother. Reynolds's mother was, you know, this just was this huge influence on his life. It's just undeniable.
Too huge. And
no one will ever love Woodcock the way his mother did.
Well, and he won't love anyone the way that he loved his mother.
Exactly. So how do you marry someone like that? We need to get this guy married in this film. How are you going to do it? Mm. Well, the introduction of this film, I think, kind of sold us. I think just by watching all these women go to work, pour that morning coffee, watching him sketch at the breakfast table, his designs, taking one bite of a croissant and setting it down. Like he eats so little in the film, except when he's, you know, I don't know, somehow he got on a vacation to go out and he meets Alma. And he orders like every hearty thing he could. He just got just a tons and tons of food.
Tons of food for the hungry boy.
Yeah, for the hungry. Oh my gosh, it's so good. Like I love that scene of her writing, and she remembers it all, and she gives him like the check or whatever.
Yeah, he wants to keep the ticket. Yeah,
that's right. And then what was it? It was he ends up having a date with her, or he spends an evening with her. And the whole thing of measuring her outfits and stuff, she's looking at it like foreplay. Like she is just totally like really, really into this and doesn't realize that he is just not at all interested in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he isn't interested in women necessarily, but he is all about material and dresses and building and his artistry. He is just absolutely 100% I would workaholic makes it sound like there's some sort of feeling about moving, you know about, oh, I'm working on this for others, I'm doing this because, you know. But like I think just the opening scenes of this, me and Samantha had just had this reaction to Woodcock and how he is and the setting and just the look and design of this film, and just immediately started falling in love. And then from there, it was just, let's figure this out. I think she even sat in with me. She sat in with me for like maybe the second half of Rebecca, which is not the way to watch that film, but I got it. Don't worry. I got her caught up. So what about you? Did you share this movie with anybody?
Nope. I watched this by myself. Again, this was just like last week. This was a library rental. Although I watched the first probably 3/4 of it. And then due to having guests in town and like a football game to go to and that kind of like other sort of once a year sort of stuff that came up, I was running out of time because we only, you know, it's a week rental for the DVDs, for the new ones. And so I had to send this back, and I was telling my guest that was at the house, and he said, well, I think this is on HBO. And I was like, oh, really? Because we have HBO.
Yeah.
And so I didn't realize that. So I was all kind of sweating getting this back to the library. And turns out I didn't need to get it at all. But I watched this by myself, and I essentially watched it twice, because after watching that first 2/3 or 3/4 I went ahead and just started it from the beginning. And as much difficulty as I had had with the master, and which I had last week, I had the exact opposite reaction with this movie. I absolutely loved the movie. I thought that this is exactly what Paul Thomas Anderson should be doing. This is the sort of thing where this is like the good Paul Thomas Anderson to me, where it is a driven, borderline obsessive man who is a genius who is at work, and we see him doing his job and doing his job well. And that's the sort of simple movie strategy or simple story strategy of, you know, you have someone do that that's very good at their job and you show them doing it well. And that's exactly what we have here. And of course he falls into every sort of driven genius sort of trope where he's too obsessed and people fall in love with him and he doesn't care. And, you know, and it's those sorts of things. He gets overworked and we have some familiar story beats, but I didn't care because I was so swept up into the performance and into the story and into this world and into this sort of innocence that Alma represented. And the fact that she was not just this doe-eyed, frail little woman, she was standing up to him at every moment's notice when she felt like she was in the right. Like when he complained that she was too loud at breakfast and she's like, I'm just buttering my bread. And he's like, well, you're doing it too loud. And she's like, I'm not doing it too loud. You're just being too sensitive, you know, and those sorts of things. And I just love the fact that he's this genius that everyone else respects and knows and is awed by. You know, we had those two young girls who meet up with him at the, at a restaurant, and they want, one of the girls wants to be buried in his dress. And that's their goal, right? And Alma witnesses this on maybe their second date or second outing. And she ultimately is kind of in awe of him, but not really of his persona as everyone else is. And I just thought that this was so marvelously acted and it was so carefully orchestrated. I just loved everything about it. And I don't know or really care to know anything about dressmaking or anything like that, but it just goes to show that it doesn't matter the subject if it's done well in a engaging way. And I could not say more positive things about the movie.
In some ways he is, you know, he is a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. And Paul Thomas Anderson is a person who, I mean, I don't know him as a person, but like through his movies, I see this like strive for making and making bigger and bigger, and he grows. Mm-hmm. That's evidenced by something like Phantom Thread or actually it is all evidenced by his last two films before Phantom Thread. Uh-huh. So I think about the making of this film. It makes me think, of course he made this film with this type of subject matter with a character like this. And he used the last two of his films to get ready for this. He with coming out with There Will Be Blood and The Master, those were relatively beloved by critics. Sure. Like they were mostly lauded the world over, right?
Right.
If you keep producing stuff like that, you become kind of the same. A lot of directors do that. I can think of a couple different directors right now that just go, you know what, I'm just going to keep making what the people want because that's who I am, and that must be what type of film I can make. Mm-hmm. Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't do that. His next two films post The Master is Inherent Vice and Junun. Mm-hmm. And those are more different than any of the other films that we've seen from him. Once again, he's experimenting. If you know, do you know anything about Junun?
No, I don't.
So he follows with him, it's my understanding that he is very much involved, obviously, with Johnny Greenwood and his work.
Right.
In terms of, you know, and he owes a lot to Johnny Greenwood for his success of what, you know, for scoring his awesome, awesome films. And so Johnny Greenwood is going over to record something or whatnot over in India. I wish I could have watched the film, but I didn't get a chance to. I will seek it out at some point. It's very limited in where it came out on Mubi first and now it's on Apple or iTunes, excuse me. So it's not very quite as available It might be in more on-demand places around, but it looks gorgeous. It's just about the creative process in building this album in India with Johnny Greenwood and a couple others. And it's shot in a way that, like, it's my understanding that it's like the creative process and how it works. And during the film, he's not afraid to just all of a sudden in the middle of the shot, pick up the tripod and walk over to a different point, all while recording. And he leaves it in. He leaves it in the film, which could be seen as like, what is he doing? Why didn't he cut? Why didn't he just move the camera and just edit out that move or whatever? But, you know, even correcting, you know, the lens and the movement, because he's all about movement in his shots and in using handheld and putting things on tripods and all sorts of different ways of known, like he's known for his Steadicam stuff early on and Magnolia and whatnot. Like there, he's able to kind of experiment a lot. And so now that he has kind of graduated with those two films, he's now ready to start talking about that process and the creative process and what it means to be this, like, you know what I mean? Like it's almost kind of like, it reminds me of when, the Coen brothers are lauded for their films post Raising Arizona, you know, Miller's Crossing comes out. I forget what else, but then they suddenly have to make another film. Or another film is being ordered, or they want to work with another studio. Please give us a script. Blah 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 blah. So they write Barton Fink, and Barton Fink is this character who is renowned and has to be this, you know, he's a playwright, but now he's got to write, you know, scripts for Hollywood scripts or whatever. And it's like, how do you, like, where do you go from being like at the summit or at the top? Like, you know, when you're the Woodcock of film in some ways, I wouldn't necessarily say he is, like, I don't know. Obviously we don't know for sure whether or not Paul Thomas Anderson is really like, but at the same time, like, there is this, like, he's maybe one of the biggest, most lauded film directors that are still alive today and making excellent work. So in some ways there are reflections in, and what's interesting is this type of story. It's almost like the relationships in Paul Thomas Anderson's life or whoever wrote that. I'm assuming it's Paul Thomas Anderson that wrote this.
Uh-huh.
Like what extremes are taken in this film, you know, to that are reflective of real life. And so I find that really fascinating about this film. And just, and also not just that, but like Daniel Day-Lewis in acting, he is lauded and celebrated, you know, around the world. And he gets kind of to pick and choose now, you know, well now he just chooses to stop, but to have the luxury of, to be Daniel Day-Lewis and whatnot, like, and being a part of that is so fascinating in terms of what the outside language of this film is projecting.
Well, and, it was funny watching this movie because I felt like this Reynolds Woodcock character was both Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
Because he is so very precise and everything has to be for the work, right? And sometimes it can be, well, this, you know, this isn't very good at all when he has that wedding dress after he's been poisoned.
Oh my gosh, yeah, and, that was...
And so we have, you know, these... and for me, watching that, this was, oh, this is... this is what I think of Paul Thomas Anderson in Inherent Vice. Well, it all came together like he wanted, but ultimately it just wasn't very good, was it? Right? And that's what I put upon that little bit. But I just think that it's interesting that it's these two, this writer and this director, who choose for Daniel Day-Lewis's last performance, and again, that's as of now, this perfectionist genius character, because I think that that's what he is oftentimes viewed as, is that's who he is as an actor, where he's embodying, you know, he's the method actor. He's embodying these characters and living this life. And they're, you know, supposedly him and, Cyril Leslie Manville, who is also tremendous in this, but they, 6 months before filming just started hanging out, so they would seem like they were actually brother and sister, so it would feel real. And so I just like that the last thing that he does is playing a role that's very similar to him in terms of obsession, and where everything has to be a certain way, or else, you know, it's no way. It has to be his way or no way. And I think that a lot can be said about Paul Thomas Anderson, the same as can be said about Reynolds Woodcock and Daniel Day-Lewis. So with that being said, I think that it is interesting to have the Alma character, because like I mentioned earlier, the thing that I like about her the most is at the beginning, she is seduced by this this hungry boy. She is fascinated by this, you know, will you do this for me? Oh, yes, of course. Will you do that for me? Oh, of course I will. And, you know, she gets her measurements taken, but then when she sees Leslie Manville and she starts getting her measurements with someone else there, and she realizes this is not foreplay, this is just him doing something for his own gain, she's not standing up straight, right? She's moving around, and he's like, well, you didn't have any, you know, she's like, well, how do you want me to stand? And you just stand like this. Well, you didn't say that, you know, and she is kind of sharp towards him. And I like that, you know, she says, you know, she sets up, and this is a little bit into the movie, but she sets up a point where they say, hey, don't make sure you don't pick any of the poisonous mushrooms. And she does. And they go to that plot point immediately. They don't let that sit and wait and stew. It's, this is a poisonous mushroom. We see it in the book. She puts it in his tea. He gets sick right away. She takes care of him. And then later on in the movie, it's like, you know what? Let's try that again, except with chunks instead of me grating it down into a dust. And he's aware of it then. And he goes along with it then. And it just says a lot about those characters. When both of them realize what's going to happen, he knows he's going to get sick. He knows she's going to have to take care of him. And that's both of their places in their lives at that, in that point in their lives. And I just really was sort of taken and sort of swept up in the whole sort of artistry of this movie.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, you're explaining it really well with how their dynamic works. Mm. And like, you don't really get a sense of what she's like before any of this?
No, although you do get a little bit of her, and this was one of the questions I had for you is, so when she initially comes out, she sees him sitting there, and she kind of bumps into some tables and is a little clumsy. And then later on when she's standing, they comment, I think at least one time, maybe two, that she can stand like no one else. Right? Like she's so still, she's so good at being this model for him. She's so good at being this muse for him. Now I wonder, is that opening bit with her sort of stumbling around, is that because she's so taken by Reynolds at the beginning? Is it because she's just so like, oh man, look at this attractive man? Or is it that she's clumsy when she's not with him, and then when she's with him, she has to be a certain way, and she has to sort of change who she is a little bit, I guess.
I like that question because it, like, it does make you wonder. And I, to me, I don't think my answer would be, I don't think that matters.
Mm, okay.
And it, because, but I do, I'm glad that the question is brought up because it, I want that wondering, you know, you make, it makes it wonder. It makes one wonder, was she like this demanding person before meeting Woodcock? And that at all does not matter. Mm-hmm. Even if she was, who cares? Like, even if she wasn't, what matters is when she's with Woodcock, she turns into this. She turns mm-hmm. into this person that needs this, and he needs that, and they have this understanding by the end of the film. And that is, she is this weird missing piece into the tapestry, or dress rather, or the thread of being a part of this machine that makes this work. All of the women that come in the morning to put the coffee on, that get to dressmaking right away. I mean, mm-hmm. he has a magic workshop full of people that stay extra hours when one thing is wrong. And, you know, one, you know, the moment she gives him the ground up mushrooms in his tea for the first time, and he's poisoned, and he falls on the dress. Why they end up staying all night to make it all over again, you know, weeks right. of work, you know, and all that. And just, she knows the power of messing up one tiny little bit of one tiny little detail can set it all off. Mm-hmm. And how many lives are touched by doing this one mm-hmm. thing in the House of Woodcock. And so, but she also, there's also a sense of discovery that happens when she does this, that he becomes so vulnerable and needs her so bad during mm-hmm. these moments. He actually becomes very sweet to her, or becomes just not this hardened perfectionist person to her.
Well, yeah, he's very childlike, which I don't think is a big mystery as to why it's that moment that the mother appears. I mean, yes, he's also probably hallucinating due to the poison, but right. you know, it's when he is at his lowest where he's the most childlike, and then his mother appears and we have that bit. And so it's Alma's trying to replace Reynolds's mother. And so she's got to make him his most infantile that she can, and that's by, you know, almost killing him. And so she, you know, likes the taking care of him, because at those moments, that's the only time that he actually really needs her, and he reminds her of that he doesn't need her. And
oh my gosh, yeah, that's another great scene.
Yeah, well, speaking of great scenes, one of the things that I wanted to mention before I forget is I love the fight right before the poison. So this is when they are sitting at the dinner table and she's decided to surprise him, even though Cyril has said that that's a bad idea. And she's decided to make asparagus with butter. And we have the whole butter talk about how he likes oil and salt and she's French and makes everything with butter, right? And so she makes this asparagus and they get in this fight. And I loved this fight because this was one of the times where she calls him out on this sort of what she sees as faux civility that he has, to where it's all Madame Monsieur and bows and all of this like play pretend house type stuff that they do. And I love the fact that whether it's script or performance or both, that the Alma character doesn't have all of the words for what she's trying to say when she's so heated and upset, because she's so upset. She's just like going, you know, and making sounds like that. And she's just pissed, and she doesn't have all of the eloquent things to say to him. And he, you know, does his normal where he snaps, you know, he like snaps at someone and tries to talk down to them, and then once that doesn't work, he eventually tells her to go fuck off, which is his big sort of coup de grace, where that's what he says when he's done with someone. And I just really liked that, because I felt like this felt like a real fight. It didn't feel like a movie fight between someone. It didn't go from like 0 to 100 right away. This was something where it was over asparagus, and the asparagus wasn't done right. He didn't want this surprise. He didn't want to be involved in this thing, and it was from her just trying to be nice and trying to get him to love her, and he's resistant to that. And so I just really liked that whole bit, and I thought that fight was really, really well orchestrated.
They're both acting like children.
Absolutely.
She's making those raspberry sounds at him, and he's always been somewhat of a child.
Oh, he is not a mature adult. Yes.
He just, you know, he like asks us, she's like a special agent sent here to ruin my evening and possibly my entire life.
Yes.
You know, is this my house? This is my house, isn't it?
Of course it's your house. Yeah. We know it's your house, you know, that sort of thing.
So childlike in his points that he's making. And then they both just have this awful whatever, but she, you know, even during those times when she's really trying to help, really trying to surprise him, her intent is good and Cyril is warning her, but she still is just like, I cannot get past this door. I'm not allowed in this door. I want to drop this tea off. And he just says, you know, like, you know, like, what does he say? He's like, well, you know, the interruption is still with me in this room.
The tea is going out. The interruption is staying right here with me. He says,
yes. I love how his lines are so wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Like in order to say stuff like that. And he is so eloquent in the way he says it, because he's part of the I don't know what you would say, like maybe the elite or something like that. Like he builds dresses and he's like renowned, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he builds dresses not in just the way that like, oh, I can't believe you got a dress from the House of Woodcock. No, he builds dresses for people for their first communion, their confirmation, and for their wedding. Mm-hmm. Like he is with them throughout their life, you know, in some ways. For some of his clients, like
yeah,
he is just
yep.
he that I mean, and to ruin that to like there's this wonderful, wonderful scene of them going to one of his clients' weddings that he just doesn't want to go to.
Oh yeah,
and she is just overly drunk, and they Alma takes it upon herself to go and get the dress off.
Well,
of them,
yeah, Barbara Rose, Barbara Rose. I put this on Twitter the other night that my goal is to go to every social event and be Barbara Rose from now on, because she is just very intoxicated at her wedding, and she's got this sort of arranged marriage type of a situation to where she's an older wealthy woman, and the other guy is he's not from England and he's also wealthy, and it's just kind of we're going to combine our wealth kind of a marriage.
Right.
And neither one of them seemed too invested. And yeah, she's very drunk and he's like, well, where's the dress? And her maid says that it, you know, she's sleeping. And he's like, he cannot believe that she's sleeping on it. And so Alma has to go and pull it off of her, which I thought, and see now something like that to me, that was funnier to me than anything in Inherent Vice, just because I was laughing at the absurdity of it and also of the sort of dedication that Alma has to Reynolds. And I think that it's because I had a lot more of a connection with those characters, to where that not ultimately humor, that not, that scene isn't the funniest movie or is the funniest thing you'll ever see in your life, but it struck a lot closer to home than something where I wasn't really enjoying it would have.
Right. It's their first caper together almost, you know, them working as a team and how, you know, I mean, it was an act of Alma's, but I mean, he didn't necessarily try to stop her.
Well, sure. And again, it shows the strength of her character where she's like, yeah, I'm not bothered by who this woman is. This woman that owns the house that Reynolds lives in, which is why he had to go. Right.
Absolutely.
And you know, Cyril reminds him of that. And Leslie Manville, again, I said that I thought she was great. I absolutely love the scene where he tries to sort of bite back at her. And he's like,
yes,
don't do that. And she's like, don't you, you know, she has that little, that very sort of British, it is like the most British thing in this British movie. It's like the, she basically warns him and says not to fight with him because he'll not come out of it alive, but yes, she's saying it while sipping her tea, while with a little smile and a shake of her head, and I was like, god damn, Leslie Manville is good. And she was nominated for this.
Oh really? Okay, good. I was gonna say that she really was a wonderful part of this. I mean, it was very much needed for a character like her to be in this.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she slowly becomes, I think her role, not in the film, but her role in the House of Woodcock,
yes,
starts to lessen. She starts to see Alma move in on her territory a
mm-hmm.
little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not as a lover, of course, but like in terms of every day, it's not just him and Cyril. Now it's him, Alma, and Cyril. And she's actually very restrained. You can tell the character is very restrained, that she has to be, well, I mean, I tried to warn you. He won't like this. Like, this isn't a good thing that you're doing. You know, this is, in fact, this is actually pretty bad.
And she's also the one who kind of finally puts into words what he's thinking about getting rid of the women, because we have that woman at the beginning and it's time for her to move on. Right. Like it.
Right.
And so she is basically not asked to return to their house. And then that's why Reynolds goes and finds Alma in the countryside, is because he doesn't have, you know, a muse at home anymore. And so he's not necessarily out looking for it, but that's how, you know, that's how the movie goes, where he ends up finding Alma out in the country.
And but he also,
go ahead.
He also has I think I just lost it. But I think he also has like this obsession with like making, well, maybe not. Like there's very much a machine and going on in the House of Woodcock, but also an obsession with not leaving the tradition behind that he always has. Mm-hmm. Alma has to conform to this one place, you know, even for their wedding, I believe their wedding reception or whatever is held at the exact same table of the same restaurant that they always go to. You know, I thought that was also really sad.
Yes.
with all that happening, but it's totally Reynolds, though. He is very much like set in his ways and will never, ever, ever break from it.
Yeah.
And the only way he can do it is by making him that vulnerable to the point where she has all the power. And it's astounding watching her go from this person who has seemingly nothing. She seems very powerless when he is just measuring her and mm-hmm. telling her, you have no breasts, you mm-hmm. have no, you know, you're this or that. And she, all of the arousal that was there is just melted. It's just right. all gone now.
Yeah.
And like now it is like, I am in full control, and he's in control for most of the film, which makes that passage of power that much more powerful.
Yeah. And it's strange because we get the power dynamics in this movie are really fascinating, because Reynolds is in charge most of the movie. We have Alma fighting back sometimes. Not ultimately like, you know, being in charge, but definitely saying, hey, you can't just walk over me. And then we get, you know, her poisoning him, and then we get him being poisoned again, which leads to them getting married. And once we got to them getting married, I was like, holy shit, this is going into like some Gone Girl sort of fucking territory. Cause I was like, wait a minute. No, I don't want them to get together. Like they're not going to be good together. Don't get together. You know? And I'm like, don't do this. And so once he proposes, I'm like, no. This is just I'm sick and you're helping me get better sort of proposal. Don't, you know, don't buy into this. And she stares at him for such a long time, and I think that that's such an important part of the film, because she's trying to decide, is this real? Is this a power move? Is this just because he's getting better? Is this because I'm his caretaker? Is that okay, and that's what I want? And he, you know, he asks her, I think, three times, and he's like, what are you looking at, or what are you waiting for, or whatever, before she finally says yes. And I just was so taken by so much of this movie. I just thought that it was so incredibly well done. And I was going to say earlier, this was nominated for six different categories at the Oscars in 2018. Mm-hmm. It did win for Best Achievement in Costume Design. And it was also nominated for Best Performance by Daniel Day-Lewis, Best Performance in a Supporting Role by Leslie Manville, Best Music by Johnny Greenwood, Best Directing by Paul Thomas Anderson, and Best Picture.
Wow. Yep.
And you didn't see Inherent Vice getting nominated for those. So
Inherent Vice won for Best Costume,
yeah.
I think.
It won for the same one that this did, yeah.
Hey, I mean, yeah. I mean, well, and it may not have gone on to Best Picture, and I can understand that totally, but at the same time, like, you know, what, you know, this, I don't know, there's something about, before I ask my question, I gotta say, Johnny Greenwood is such an essential part of the House of Anderson in some ways. like right. He is almost like an essential cog. He's a very, I wouldn't even say he's a cog, he's like a machine in his own right, that is just pumping out amazing music to go along with these fantastic visuals. He works with really good photographers, but also like the just some of these pieces are incredible. Even in this film, I know he's worked with him on every single film since There Will Be Blood, right? He didn't mm-hmm. go with yeah. him before this. Nope. Okay, yeah. Man, and there's one thing I can say for certain is Johnny Greenwood has always been like consistently amazing in every one of the films. For as much as things didn't really go as planned in Inherent Vice, probably, you know, for us or our expectations or whatnot, I still think the quality of the score is consistent. He's just an essential talent to all of this. But anyways, I wanted to move over to a question about, I probably shouldn't ask a question. I should probably should just say my question was going to be, do you feel entirely satisfied with the ending story, you know, narrative wise of this film? Because I feel like, and maybe that was kind of a leading question a little bit, because I might as well just say, I kind of felt like I was dissatisfied with, well, not dissatisfied. I felt satisfied mostly, but I wanted more. I wanted to find out what happened more, you know, like at least with There Will Be Blood, your time with Daniel Plainview is over. I mean, he is essentially done. I mean, he says he's finished.
Yeah, I'm finished, yeah.
And he is essentially, he is gone. He is the third revelation. He is the one that will you know, stop you, you know, you meaning Eli and whatnot. So, and then in The Master, it's very clear that I can't think of his name, but Phil Seymour Hoffman's.
Oh, sorry.
Phil Seymour Hoffman's character is gonna have to stay here in London, and now Joaquin Phoenix's character. For some reason, I'm having problems remembering their names from the films, but it's pretty clear that they are done. They're like, that partnership has ended, mm-hmm. you know, and it's time to move on. Even in Inherent Vice, like there's kind of an arc that kind of ends, you know, with them. This is the first time I feel like now I want to see where they go. I want to see how this marriage continues. And maybe that's not the story that's being told here. It's just both of us, like, just our spines are chilling at the thought of what's coming next. Mm. And oh my gosh, like where they leave it in this film, now that they're married and they have a system worked out. Oh my, are they going to ruin each other and the people around them, and it's just going to not turn out great. And I kind of wanted to see where that went, but in a way, maybe not. I don't know. Like,
yeah. I think that I'm glad that it ends where it does. And I think okay. that you're hitting on why I'm glad there, because I like the fact that it ends in a place where here's how this couple was formed. And now, from now on, you're going to see this power dynamic ebb and flow between the two of them, to where he's going to kind of keep stretching out and try to distance himself from her until she reels him back in and either makes him sick or does something to where he needs her. And it's just going to keep doing that back and forth. And so I think that anything beyond what we already saw would just get to be repetitive.
It is kind of the beginning of the end for yeah. The House of Woodcock. Yeah. Like that, like you, this movie is the mark of where the deterioration of Reynolds himself. I mean, you continue activity like this, eventually Reynolds will die, especially probably at his age in his 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Like he is just going to be ruined by the end of it. And she's going to keep raking him through all this and eventually become, I mean, I would argue that she's already corrupt herself
mm-hmm.
In terms of treating someone, another human being like this.
Oh, she justifies it for sure. But yeah, she's turning into a terrible person. Yeah.
They both justify this as if they are, well, and they, we call it disguising it. Or I would call it, oh, they're disguising their love by doing this, but it's not. Like, it's not, Like they I truly believe they love each other because of this. They have to build themselves to this point in order to get, so that's where we're at. So
I don't know. It's quite a piece of work. I think that it's, you know, I don't know what else I can add to how much I enjoyed the film. What did you think of the title of Phantom Thread?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because
we have the
whole, like, him hiding the actual things in clothing, the names. Right?
Yeah, right.
We have the sort of the phantom that's walking around in his mind as his mother. Right. And we also have this phantom idea of love that's also, you know, sort of floating around. So for me, it was Phantom Thread equals love, because that's the sort of thing that he's always sort of grasping towards or trying to get. And, you know, that's why his mother sticks around, because that's what he's sort of, that's always what he's sort of, trying to find, is someone that's like that, or that he can connect with in that way, and like in a motherly sort of a fashion, I guess. Because we don't really see him too interested in intercourse or anything like that, although she, you know, there's a carriage at the end of this movie. And so that's not really a thing until the very end of the film.
I want to say I listened to one of the podcasts I listen to on a regular basis. I think it might have been the director's cut.
Okay.
With from the DGA. And they had Rian Johnson asking Paul Thomas Anderson questions on stage. And I want to say this is where I heard this, but Phantom Thread is referring to, and this is such a Paul Thomas Anderson answer if it is, but like the women that used to work in these shops would be working all day on the same motions and the same threads and the same things on these dresses, that they would go home and in their sleep be doing the same motions with their hands when there's nothing there, like a phantom, a phantom, you know, fabric and thread that's there. And so like, it's also just cool sounding. Like it just sounds so awesome.
Well, I guess that would make sense to where it's like Alma and Reynolds going through the same motions over and over and over.
Yeah, that you would go through in love.
Mm-hmm.
But is it, you know, to those women
is
that are
real
dreaming?
Is it real or is it not? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's real to them because they're dreaming. But in some ways, they're not waking up from this dream. They're always going to be this. Let me do this for you. Let me do this for you. No, let me drive. No, I want to drive. They both have to find this balance. And they find it by the end of the film so perfectly. And it's just such a... It's just such a weird mess of a life that no one in their right mind would want to be a part of.
Yeah. Well, he's successful, so people would want that. He's, you know, well regarded, but he's also so obsessive to where it's not like he can enjoy anything that he really does.
Right.
So there's nothing really to be enjoyed in his life. So, I don't know.
I was wondering if they were going to suddenly reveal, make that was that, that there might be one tiny little knock against the film that I kind of wish, I don't know. No, maybe not. I don't know. I just like this idea that she's being interviewed by somebody throughout the film.
Yeah. And by the suddenly, is it by the doctor?
By the doctor, by the young doctor. And you find out when he first gets sick for the first time that who he is, who she's talking to, finally. Yeah. And I thought that was going to be more of a reveal. And I guess I shouldn't nitpick, because that comes, now that I think about it, that comes in right at the right moment. Cause you don't find out that he's a doctor quite then, but he is sitting there talking to her, you know, and then there in the amber glow of the fire, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And it reveals his face, but doesn't, you know, up until this point, you just see her face up close, just talking to somebody, you know, so now they finally reveal who he is, but you don't know what he is doing.
Right.
So I guess I kind of like that a little bit better. They slowly but surely reveal that he is the doctor, and she does kind of look a little bit crazy being interviewed, as she's picking those mushrooms or whatever. So.
Right. Yeah, and I do like the fact that they did tease the idea that she was going to either not need Reynolds or get tired of him and go with this doctor. Because when that horrible woman party that they go to, and they keep they sort of flirt with Reynolds as this obsessive like stalker of his own wife stuff
right,
after they get together, and so I was glad that that didn't go very much further, because it did show a little bit of he does need her and he does care about her as much as he sort of doesn't want to. So
right,
I don't know. Well, anything else about Phantom Thread, Mr. Teed?
I don't think so. I think we have everything pretty well covered in terms of what I've experienced. But I'm forever going to be popping in this one, you know, every few years or whatever, because I think it looks really nice sitting right next to my other PTA film. So I'm so excited. I don't even know what's next. Do we have any idea what's next for Paul Thomas Anderson?
You know, he doesn't have anything announced, at least on IMDb, so I'm not sure.
So it's my understanding that, like, in between films, like, he was having problems trying to get The Master off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was working on Inherent Vice and other bits of things, you know, before all these. So I think maybe that's kind of when Phantom Thread and all that was being developed during that time of trying to figure this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder what else is in the works or what else he's come up with. Not that I'm sitting there demanding more and more, but, you know, I wouldn't mind, you know, a long stretch of films from this really great director.
Yeah, I mean, anymore, he's not real prolific. I mean, we had Punch Drunk Love in 02. There Will Be Blood in 07, so 5 years there. The Master in 2012, so another 5 years there. Inherent Vice is at 14, so that's just 2 years apart. Janoon, if you count that was just a year apart. And then Inherent Vice is 2014, so that was 2 years from The Master, like I said. And then it was Phantom Thread is 3 years. So it's like it probably every 3-4 years maybe.
Right.
So we're looking at 2020, 2021, something like that. So that's a long wait.
No offense to Kurosawa-san, but he, who I consider a master,
mm-hmm.
I guess when we watched his films, I didn't notice necessarily as much growth as I have here in terms of cinematic language and storytelling, technology, just all around. Talent. I just feel like it was so fascinating watching young Paul Thomas Anderson in the 90s grow into the now over 50 Paul Thomas Anderson that we know in 2018. So
mm-hmm.
I'm just excited for whatever. I mean, even if he wants to do nothing like this again, I really would. I would be satisfied. I'd be sad that I wouldn't be getting anything else from him, but I truly believe that he could end now and still remain one of the best. So
yeah, absolutely. So he's made eight movies. I'm going to put you on the spot for the top two and the bottom two. So let's start with the bottom two first.
I might cheat here. You said bottom two first?
Bottom two first, yeah.
I actually did watch, was it Coffee and Cigarettes or Cigarettes and Coffee, one of them. Cigarettes and Coffee. I actually watched that one, and it's just not the same as Hard Eight. But I also would place, you know, if I'm not cheating, my bottom, if I am cheating, the bottom two would be the Dirk Diggler story and Coffee and
is two shorts are, before
it's
yes.
two shorts or whatever, right? But if I'm going to pick his features, I think it would probably be Inherent Vice and oh gosh, this sucks. This sucks so bad.
Well, that's why I picked two. That's why I said two.
Right. Inherent Vice is probably the very bottom,
mm-hmm.
but that's still a good film, which means that I think that if I were to pick, let's go with Heart 8.
Okay.
It's so good though. Gosh, I feel terrible now, but let's pick his best, his best, mm-hmm. his best. I'm going to go ahead and place, my favorite is probably There Will Be Blood. Of course. I can just watch that from beginning of to course. End all yep. the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, now that I've seen Phantom Thread, I think I might place that at the top too.
Wow. Okay.
They're in the top two. I really, really, really like that one, but I love Boogie Nights though.
You like The Master a lot, I know too.
I do. I still think that one's in comparison to Phantom Thread. Phantom Thread, or if one of them's gone forever.
Yeah, you can't ever see any one of them.
I'm going to pick, you know what? This sucks so bad, but I'm going to pick Boogie Nights. I'm going to do There Will Be Blood and Boogie Nights as my top two.
Interesting.
Phantom Thread, You're Gone Forever, but God damn it, you're so damn good.
Yes.
And everything else would be pretty much in the middle there. I like them all, you know, relatively. So,
yeah.
All right. I need to know your bottom two. I could probably pick those for you.
I mean, my bottom one is Inherent Vice, right? Sure. What would my next one be, though?
Oh, probably The Master?
Yeah, The Master. And that's what's so strange is that movie, there's several people, including Mr. Teed, who like that, and they
Love
are
it.
Opinions that I respect. I just thought it was
so, weird.
I just thought it was so impenetrable.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get along with it. And what's weird is those are the two Joaquin Phoenix ones, so maybe I do have a problem with him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't think about that. Two of my favorites here are Phantom. Well, my not my top two, but remember how much trouble Daniel I had Day getting Lewis, rid of bad Daniel Day-Lewis in it, and he is entirely watchable.
Well,
in both films.
We didn't really mention him, but how fantastic of an actor do you have to be Daniel Plainview, Abraham Lincoln, and Reynolds Woodcock? I mean,
those
that is
three
the same guy. That is
different.
Unbelievable that that's the same
yeah.
guy.
Right.
Well, not to mention the butcher from Martin Scorsese's
oh, that's right. yeah.
Gangs of New York. So he's incredible. Like, I just can't wrap my brain around how good he is. But if I were to say that my favorite two, I would have never thought this before because the first time I saw it, I struggled with it so mightily. I would go with There Will Be Blood for my favorite one. My second one, I'm going to go, and this is very, very close for me because of the emotional impact it had, but I would go with Magnolia and not.
Yep. That would have been my guess.
Yeah.
Right.
So there you go. So that's the definitive list. No other lists are valid.
All the rest of the movies are burning in the fire right
that's
now.
That's right. No, you know, the ones that didn't even get mentioned, like Punch Drunk.
I'm not allowed ever to go and get, Eric's copy of Magnolia ever. In
yeah.
fact, it's just blotted out from my vision, and I'm not able ever able
right.
to watch it from now
you
on.
You can't
so.
Hear about me just weeping watching that video. That is
Dang.
Correct. Okay, well, anything else about Paul Thomas Anderson before we say goodbye to the writer-director?
Just reiterating again how much I loved watching this director's progression and how excited I am to go into the future. And see all of his other films that didn't get burned because they haven't been made yet. Lucky us.
Right.
And yeah, I'll be right there. I mean, and the other thing is too, now that I've learned his language sort of cinematically, or have I? Because he keeps switching it up on us.
He is slippery.
Now that I've learned that language, I know now to maybe if I didn't get it the first time, maybe give it a couple of tries. Maybe watch it. You know, his films really lend for multiple viewings. Because they're not like it's not like a second viewing like Requiem for a Dream or anything else by Darren Aronofsky. Like mm-hmm. his stuff tends to be one timer type of stuff, but they end up being really good. But I don't know, like this one is you may not get it the first time. You may think you have expectations, but he's going to show you stuff that you may need to give more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Phantom Thread was probably the one that went down the easiest, really.
Really?
Even my first time seeing There Will Be Blood, I think I had this weird, like, what? Like, what? Why did they do that?
Well, Phantom Thread feels like a very classic Hollywood period piece kind of a movie.
Yeah, it's the most Hitchcock, which Hitchcock has always been this, like, easily digestible filmmaker that makes these, he builds these moments that a human, the human condition, you can understand. Like, so I think this is his kind of homage to that.
Well, there you go.
Thank you so much for this. This was amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
We've graduated from PTA school now.
We did. We've dabbled in Kubrick and Cohen and Kurosawa and now PTA.
Woohoo!
So we've got quite the little badges of completion so far. Although the other ones we just kind of picked here and there. We didn't do any sort of soup to nuts kind of a situation. Kurosawa would be doing this for 10 years.
Oh my God. Yes.
So, yes. So, thank you very much again, Mr. Teed. Wrapping us up, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies you'd like to hear us talk about, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle's at plainlabelpod, where you can follow me. I'm at EricWilliams79. We also have a Facebook page and an account over at Instagram. Just look up Plain Label Podcast and you'll find us. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could check out our show notes where you'll find the link to our Amazon wish list and our Audible link where, again, you can get something for free just by signing up. So I do want to thank Mr. Ben Teed, even though, like Alma might say, that he needs to settle down a little bit. If people wanted to hear more from Mr. Teed or get in touch with you, where could they do that?
I'm at Ben Teed on both Letterboxd and Twitter. That's where you'll see my star reviews. And you can comment on them, complain about anything.
The controversial star ratings of,
yes,
of things.
And what,
yes,
they mean and are, you know, what do they mean to you?
That's right. And so thank you for listening. And next week, Rachel and I will be back and we'll be talking about decidedly less meaty films than Paul Thomas Anderson movies as we continue our theme of young adult films. And this time we're talking about YA movies from the 2000s and we're discussing the films Whatever It Takes and Ghost World.